Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, Rabbi Ken Spiro. So nice to be back together.
Absolutely. So much fun. Been waiting for this for a long time.
As we all have with our crazy busy schedules. But we're going to start off. We're not like creeping back in. We're basically blazing a trail forward with our topic today. So today we are going to delve into taking a look at the religious world today, and using history to try to understand how did we get to where we are now. So it's kind of a history of the from world. Would you say it like that, or where are we going and where should we start?
Yeah, well, definitely it's the status of the, you know, Orthodox world today, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, why it is the way it is. How did it get to where it is? It's not, It tends to be a tendency to think that it's always been this way, but yeah, just as Judaism, what we call Torah observant Judaism, or I don't like the word orthodoxy, but has evolved tremendously due to changing political, geopolitical, historical circumstances. So too, within that changes, there's been huge differences in what's happened to the Jews of the Middle East versus the Jews who lived in Christian Europe. And it's by no means what it is today, despite the tendency to romanticize it, is no means what it was before. And it continues to evolve.
So what did Jewish observance, if you think about an observant community, look like historically? And how did that travel and change as we lost the first temple, lost the second temple, and then ended up in the diaspora? So I think you're right. I think a lot of us look at the religious community today and say, oh, that's what Moshe wore as he moved through the desert, right? He had a black hat and a white shirt, and that's what it all looked like. So, but I suspect that probably wasn't the case. But so what did it look like back then? And how did it evolve to where we are now? Where should we begin?
Right. So if we really rewind to the beginning, we have to remember that originally we're one people living in one land, where we had one court system called the Sanhedrin, which decided for the entire Jewish people. You know, with the diaspora experience, the decentralization of Judaism led to an amazing topic, which is how we created a portable version of our faith that enabled us to remain Jewish and practice Judaism without the vital organs of what is really Judaism, which is all Jews living in Israel, you know, Jewish government with a king, a Sanhedrin, a high priest, a temple service. These are like very huge parts of Judaism. We are lacking. It's like a body missing major limbs and organs, and we think it's whole, but it really is not. It's very different from what it was originally.
I think we weren't even called Jews at that time. Judaism is like a word that we use to, as part of that portable version, to what do we call ourselves when we're not in our own land? Oh, we call ourselves like Yehudim from the tribe of Yehuda. So, which is such an interesting thing. So many people hear that and they're like, what do you mean?
Exactly.
What were we called then?
And there were no Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and there was no Hasidim and Misnagdim, and there was, we don't realize how diverse we become for better and for worse, but it's so different. We would not recognize in many ways what the Judaism was. Obviously the basic things we would, but there's many things we would not recognize because so much of it are layers that have been added on by the diaspora experience and from absorbing tremendous amounts of things from other cultures. And having to adopt, but with the destruction of the first temple 2,500 years ago, we have the creation of the first diaspora community, which is today in a country called Iraq, but back then we called it Babylon. So that's amazing. That's 2,500 years ago, which is way before, by the way, any Arabs or Islam was in the Middle East. We predate even those people who are the predominant religion and culture of the Middle East today. We're not there at the time in that part of the world. And that community will continue until basically 1948, 1967, wow. Pretty much with, by the time we get to the Six-Day War, the Arab world has ethnically cleansed itself of the vast, vast, vast majority of its Jewish population.
Right.
Many of whom were there way before the Arab world was there and way before these Arab states existed. Mm-hmm. But that is that beginning of a diaspora experience. We come back, we have a second temple period, but that we're still going to have Babylon exists. It's, you know, that's the community that the main community of the land of Israel has to deal with. But that's the last time that the majority of Jews as a whole will be in Israel is the first temple period. And by the time you get to the end of the second temple period, I estimate that maybe in the second temple period prior to the destruction, only a third of the Jews in the world are living in Israel. And now they've spread not just to Babylon, but with other empires conquering us from the West in the second temple period, the Greeks, the Romans. Jews will, with the spread of these empires, especially the spread of the Roman Empire, expand with the Roman Empire until we have Jews settling around the entire Mediterranean, whether it's North Africa, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Turkey, whether it's Eastern Mediterranean, Italy and Greece, all the way over to Spain. There is Jewish communities that predate the destruction of the Second Temple who are already starting to evolve, right? Different. The difference is until the year 70, destruction of the temple, you have the temple service still going on.
Right. So that's what I was going to say. At that point, are we still somewhat unified in our observance, unified in our practice? Does it sort of look the same for everybody?
Yes and no, in that the vast majority of the population can't make it back to Jerusalem for things like Passover. You know, you're supposed to sacrifice the Paschal lamb, but we know that if you're too far away, you are exempt from the commandments. So
there wasn't necessarily instituted yet this idea of a Passover Seder in your own home. It was a pilgrimage festival. You would go to the temple.
Again, it's hard to know that exactly. The Haggadah has evolved and it goes back very far. And the other commandment is Sapir Yisit Mitzrayim, talking about the Exodus from Egypt. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that even people who are in far-flung communities who are keeping track of time may not be able to, like we do today, not eat the Paschal lamb, but still symbolically, you know, talk about it and still retell the story, which is the other commandment. But the difference, Ellie, is that you may not have a temple after the year 70, but we have a Sanhedrin until the mid-4th century, albeit often persecuted, often in hiding. This is often on periods of intense Roman persecution of the Jewish community in the land of Israel, which is slowly dwindling till the mid-4th century when the Sanhedrin, which is sitting in Tiberias, goes out of existence. That is a huge change in the Jewish world, because now we no longer have the central body which can decide for the entire Jewish people. And that's a massive, massive difference in the Jewish world.
Right.
And that's what we live in, a world today which now has decentralized authority and many different opinions on many different things.
Yeah, so that seems like such a wild transition. Like, not only once we lose the Second Temple, do we lose our main modes of practice and self-identification, but first of all, it's absolutely traumatic, meaning people are killed, people are kicked out of their homes, we think about it today, we mourn on Tisha B'Av, we're in the 3 weeks now, this idea that we have, but for ourselves to put ourselves in the shoes of people, thousands of whom are displaced from their homes, thousands of whom are killed, it's really hard for us to imagine today what that must have been like. And not only how challenging just leaving the country, but then having to reestablish themselves, you know, no internet, no banks, no nothing. Like, you're literally, you have a sack on your back and you're getting to wherever you can get to in terms of safety, and having to start your life completely over again.
Absolutely. And the bigger trauma was certainly the first temple. We had lived for 840 years in the land of Israel, you know, first temple period, and the judges before 850 years, excuse me.
Wow.
And that there must have been a lot of doubt in people's minds. You know, we had the prophets, we had prophecy still, and they're telling us God will remember us, like Jeremiah, 70 years will come back. But people are probably waiting with bated breath to see if it would happen. I would imagine that as traumatic it was on a physical level, on the second destruction of the second temple, people at least been there, we done that. We know we can survive, you know, in diaspora. But I imagine once the Sanhedrin goes out of existence, again, we take it for granted. We're all like people who were born blind.
Right.
We don't appreciate what it was like to live when the temple stood, when there was centralized authority, and when we had a one court that could tell us what to do for everyone, albeit it might take a long time to get that information back and forth.
Right.
You see, before cell phones and before internet.
Yeah, but I don't think any of us can imagine a Judaism with one centralized leadership.
Right.
Where there was, you know, one, you know, way to start to understand the next step in this situation. We're absolutely, number one, diverse, but also divided in terms of leadership. So we can't even imagine what that would look. I mean, look, one of the biggest jokes is, right, two Jews, three shuls, you know, one you will never go to. It's
exactly.
Very challenging.
Exactly, exactly. But again, we're like people who are born blind. We don't even remember what normative Judaism is. And not only that, we think that being in our handicapped state is normative, and it's not. And I tell people, it's, I know I like to like give people a poke and shock them a little, but I tell people the diaspora is a desecration of God's name. The existence of a diaspora is a chilul Hashem. It is. To say otherwise, you can't say otherwise. It's a punishment. Banished from the land of Israel is a punishment. The problem is we've been doing it for so long, and it's become so comfortable living on Bathurst and something, or Lakewood, or Northwest London.
Right.
But we don't realize it. So we think what is the abnormal has become the normal. And not only that, because we've been so diverse and split up, we think what we do, whatever mode of dress, how we eat, the music we sing, the tunes we have, the way we pray differently, that's normal. That's correct. That's right. And these are all byproducts of the very often very difficult situation we found our in exile and scattered around the world and unable to unify around one common mode of practice that everyone could buy into.
Yeah, that's so interesting what you say too, because, you know, what comes to mind is like, we keep thinking the dungeon is the palace, right? And we've made the dungeon a palace. You know, where we were sent, kicked out of our land, we've made palatial in so many ways, right? The wealth, the education, the, you know, the setup of the school systems, all of these things, we've created incredible things in the diaspora. But I think you're right. We've forgotten that it's not supposed to be that way.
Right. And I'm not talking about Jews who are disconnected from Judaism. They don't know any better. I'm talking about the religious Jews. Some of them who I think may be very shocked when the Messiah actually comes, we have to return to Israel. I got to actually live there. Even though I'm praying for it three times a day.
In that really small apartment.
I really came. Oh my God. No, seriously. That's the problem. That's what happens when you stay in a situation for literally thousands of years.
Right. So how do we get there? So we get to, we end up in the diaspora. We have both Sephardi and Ashkenaz, which we didn't have before. For those of you, if you'd like a more in-depth history of the history of Sephardim and the history of Ashkenaz, you can look at episodes in season 2, where I believe we go over those histories in depth. But we end up with these two distinct communities. What does that look like? How does that look? What's the percentage also of Sephardim to Ashkenaz in the beginning? Because I think a lot of the time we think Ashkenaz is really how Judaism went, especially living in North America. But what does that look like at first?
Right. That's another huge change that's taken place. Ashkenaz is a term for, it means Germany, but it's actually Jews who are living in what we call the Christian world of Europe, not necessarily Western Europe, because the most Western part of Europe was, for 700 years, Spain, what is today Spain, and Muslim. And Sephardi means actually Spain, but it really is Edot HaMizrach, the communities of the East, which tend to be communities who lived under Islam. Obviously, that's the earliest communities in the Middle East ones, Babylon. And with the oppression of the Romans for hundreds of years, you know, first century, second century, etc., most Jews who are fleeing, it's much easier to go by land to other places in the Middle East and then to cross the Mediterranean.
Right.
And it's also places that are outside the Roman Empire, like the Persian Empire, which was more tolerant of Jews at the time when there was massive oppression, not just in Israel, but in diaspora communities. It was constant tension between the pagan people of the Mediterranean Roman Empire and the Jewish community. But also, Ellie, there's a Jewish community that expands, I said, with the Roman Empire, looking for economic opportunities, because Jews are always opportunity seeking. And as the empire expands, that opens up new frontiers for economic development, trading and crafts and things like that. Like glass blowing is a uniquely Jewish skill. The spread of glass, which is always associated with the Roman Empire, could well be largely associated with the spread of Jews within the Roman Empire. It's a very highly skilled art form. So there are Jews living in Europe at the same time as the Romans are oppressing us in the Middle East. So that community is also very old. But by the time you get to around the 4th, 5th centuries, the Sanhedrin has ceased to exist. The Jewish community in Israel has shrunk to almost nothing. There's always some Jews living in Israel, but the majority of Jews are definitely living in the Middle East. How many Jews? We don't know. A million plus. There's many massive killouts of Jews. So our population shrinks dramatically from maybe 6-8 million Jews 2,000 years ago to possibly maybe, 15-20% of that, with all that happened, all the trauma that we went through. But initially, this is something people don't appreciate. The vast majority of Jews are living in what will become the Edot HaMizrach, the communities of the East, which is originally those communities right around us, especially in what is Persia and Iraq of today. But everywhere, out to the Hijaz of what is Saudi Arabia, you have Jews trading, and then moving through, especially with the spread of Islam through North Africa, Jews moving into there, which is basically in the late 7th, early 8th centuries. North Africa becomes, there's been Jews living there also in the time of the Roman Empire. It was one time part of the Roman Empire. But if we go back 1,000 years ago, Ellie, 90% of the Jews in the world are speaking Arabic as their first language.
Wow.
And living in the Middle East, North Africa, and of course, by 7-Eleven, they're living in Spain, which, by the way, starts as an outlier community. Spain was the end of the earth.
Wow. You know?
Even when Israel ceases to be the central community, spiritually, it's always our central community. But when Iraq, kind of with the collapse of the land of Israel, the Babylon, the Babylonian Talmud, the sages of Babylon will really be the center of the Jewish world. Spain is the end of the earth.
Wow.
It really is. As Spain establishes itself, it becomes a very fertile environment economically and even and tolerant spiritually in the 8th to the 11th centuries. It will itself become really one of the major centers of the Jewish world. So it starts like America was, by the way, in the 16th century, when Jews are fleeing from persecution of the Spanish Inquisition after the expulsion in 1492. America was the end of the world you went to.
Right.
We colonized maybe Spain and Portugal, but at least they can't, the Inquisition can't chase us there yet. They did. But now you think, what's the central community outside of diaspora today? Is precisely the place was the outlier community going back 500 years ago.
It's so fascinating when you think about all these communities. Like North America was like, the furthest we could get from persecution, but also each running away from persecution was further and further away from the land of Israel, from our home that was given to us. So it's fascinating to think that the more the persecution continued, the further and further away we were getting from the seat of the temple.
Well, you can look at it on a higher level, as it says in the prophets, like God says, I'll scatter you amongst the nations as a farmer scatters seed. The whole diaspora experience is sort of a digression from what we're talking about, but it's interesting in that we enriched and were enriched. We enriched other people by bringing our knowledge, not just obviously not just crafts and things like glass blowing, but our knowledge of God and our value system to the world, which is how we were able to, one way or another, the world has to come back to God. So if they don't come to us, we go to them. And they enriched us by giving us cultural diversity. I always say if all the Jews in the world ate gefilte fish, it would be very sad. So which creates the very
or
diverse
herring,
Jewish
in
world
which
we
case
have today.
I would quit.
Right. We also got to remember, Ellie, that we've lost what is authentic Jewish culture. Nothing that everyone thinks is authentic, whether it's how I dress, how I pray, the tunes I use, the spices in my food, or the spices I don't have my food of Ashkenazi because I think salt is a spice. That all comes from it's a byproduct of where we lived and amongst whom we lived. Even how I dress is a product of A, culture, and B, climate.
Yeah.
You can talk about, not to jump into this topic, but the Hasidic world that wears these strimals and the klopiks, these hats, this is not something that one would naturally wear in the Middle East.
Yes.
It's taken from European nobility in a place where in the winter was 50 below zero. One could say that maybe it's not the most comfortable thing to wear in August in Jerusalem. That's a separate discussion. But people bring these things in, and they have to realize none of this is authentically and originally Jewish. We don't know what that is. It would be so much fun to beam ourselves back. You see in these virtual VR things they do.
Yeah, totally.
Are they just Jews? Mostly like Arabs with keffiyehs on and things. And we don't know. We don't know.
Yeah, to really see what a Jewish daily life look like when we actually had the temple.
My intuition is the Sephardic world that stayed in the Middle East is closer, not because they're more honest about it, but because of the cultural and geographic proximity to the land of Israel would make it more like that. The further away you get, like the Shrimal and the Kapata outfit is the least close to how Jews used to dress, not because of anything wrong with this per se, but only because it's so culturally and climactically alien to this part of the world. So now we just got to get it.
And I think it's really interesting just from a trauma perspective, because if we look at an entire people who are now kicked out of their land, most likely have lost people, relatives, family, going back generations, have been persecuted, have been, you know, hiding their Jewishness, having to, you know, navigate a world that largely others them on a regular basis. You know, anybody who knows anything about dealing with trauma and anxiety knows there are certain things that you go to as a coping mechanism when we're afraid, which most Jews were probably living afraid on a daily basis for, you know, entire generations. So you have this fight, flight, freeze, and fawn response, right? Fight being, you know, getting angry and going against. Flight being running away, which is what we spent a lot of our time doing, and moving to different countries and trying to find different places where we could live safely and practice Judaism without persecution. Freeze being just sort of holding, you know, maybe if I just stay this way, we'll be okay. And fawn, which is the fourth thing that they've added, which is this sort of people pleasing. And I think if we look at freeze and fawn, you know, what you said about this idea of dressing like the Polish aristocracy, there's a certain level of just like, okay, if we just stay still and stay exactly the same way that we were then, there's a certain safety in that. There's a knowing in that. There's a feeling comfortable in that, which is totally understandable when you think of the level of trauma that was already in the community even before we get to the Shoah, which we haven't even talked about yet. So what were these people doing in order to try to regulate and navigate the level of anxiety that they must have been living in on a regular basis? And I think that's really fascinating to watch it play out over thousands of years.
Yeah, and especially given that it's not like an immigrant culture where you have to adapt and, you know, mom and dad don't speak the language, but we're going to melt in. We were always, for most of our history, trying to maintain our separateness, which is sort of counterproductive to what you're trying to do in terms of being accepted, since racism and hatred is driven by dislike of the different. So that's caused us to try and balance between, you know, dealing with the outside world and physically surviving, while at the same time maintaining our uniqueness, our particularist identity in that situation. It's a really interesting idea. And the trauma also builds on itself. There's no question. You know, we go to a place, by the time we get to like that second diaspora experience after the destruction of the Second Temple, we're much more used to the notion of living outside the land of Israel. But it largely depends also, Ellie, on where we ended up. If you happen to end up in a place that is nice and tolerant, like Jews in Spain is such an interesting example, Islamic law, dhimmitude, you know, it's kind of institutionalized apartheid. People should read up on this term, D-H-I-M-M-I. But precisely because the Umayyad dynasty that ruled Spain from the 8th to the 11th centuries, when Spain was first conquered by the Muslims, was not particularly stringent in keeping those discriminatory laws against non-Muslims, meaning Jews and Christians who were living in Spain, you had this great symbiosis. And because it was a religious culture that was the dominant culture, but not fanatically religious, being religious was also cool and acceptable. You know, if you're trying to be religious in the Soviet Union when they're suppressing religion, it's really, really hard.
Right.
If you're trying to be a different religion in a country that's fanatically another faith, then it's really, really hard. But when we're the moderately religious people, which is what Islam was at the beginning, by the way, much more enlightened and open then they had their Renaissance way before the rest of the world. They were rediscovering the classical knowledge and reintroducing it and allowing Jews and Christians to interact in that. You had a really interesting situation where, yes, there were explosions and violence and a certain level of unease, I'm sure, in the collective Jewish conscience, but people got pretty comfortable out there in America. And today, with there's not like a lot of open anti-Semitism, open discrimination, which, by the way, allowed for a unique phenomenon in that culture specifically, which was Jews who were able to excel, stay Jewish, stay proudly Jewish, maintain their level of identity, study, learn, grow, be great Torah scholars, and also because the world was open to them academically, and the Muslim world was fascinated with the study and expansion of the classical knowledge of Greece and Rome. They Jews took a huge role in that, translating documents, transmitting knowledge, and you have rabbis who were great minds at the same time in the secular sphere. Like the Rambam is the classic example, who was, I always say, his mother was so happy. He was arguably the greatest lawyer, the greatest doctor, and the greatest rabbi. It was like the trifecta. But you had many other people like that who were into cartography and navigation equipment. Levi ben Gershon, making the sextant we used to navigate. The whole age of exploration was largely fueled by Jews. You have that something, and something has never been reproduced in the Jewish world since that period of time of Jewish accomplishment in both spheres, which was ahead, I think it was limited trauma. There were definitely explosions of anti-Jewish violence, but limited trauma and a lot of symbiosis between the cultures and a diaspora experience that was quite unique, which unfortunately doesn't last.
I think that's really interesting too, because I remember hearing about how some of the rebbes and great rabbis that came from the time of the Holocaust, before the Holocaust, many of them were in university in Berlin. Like they were studying high academic subjects as well as, Torah and Gemara and all of those things. Like it, but it's, I definitely think it's more the exception than the rule. So I think it's such an interesting thing to see a deeply spiritual Jewish community that is also absolutely involved in the world and is learning from the best of the knowledge that's out there, both sharing it and learning it. It's a fascinating combination to think about.
Right. You're definitely right about that. You had people like the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rev Huttner and Nechama Leibowitz. They were all like, I think, in university in Germany together at the same time. But those were the exceptions, not the rule. That Ashkenazi experience in later history is far less like what the Sephardic world went to in that period of time. But what we get created in diaspora, I mean, for the most of Jewish history, after, again, this is another thing we don't appreciate. The religious world doesn't really understand this anymore, especially the Ashkenazi religious world, that the vast majority of Jews were just, I would say simple, not simple intellectually, but they did what they did. They practiced what they practiced. They learned a little on the side, and they were basically craftsmen and artisans and people like that who were. We'd call them traditional. You could call them Orthodox in that they kept Shabbat and kosher and laws of family purity and things like that. But that was the Jewish world, as the vast majority of Jews existed through most of Jewish history. You don't have movements like Reform and conservative. You may have Jews, you don't have these attempts, modern Ashkenazic European attempts of Jews to create versions of Judaism which really allow them to kind of minimize their Judaism on the side while maximizing their ability to interact and take advantage of European culture, which is where Reform movement really comes out of. So that has changed dramatically too. And that Jewish world really doesn't even exist so much anymore. Those
So
simple
where are we on the
traditional Judaism.
timeline that experience of like having it be very somewhat balanced? Where
Right.
does that exist
So
in
if you go back
time?
to European history, so if we go back 1,000 years ago, most Jews were living in the Arab world, the Islamic world, a lot in Spain. It's not all perfection and rosy color, but Jews had already been there a long time, and we had basically reached a modus vivendi, as they say, an operating mode where we could get along and in some places be quite flourish with the Christian reconquest of Spain. And by the way, fanatic groups of Muslims like the Berbers crossing the Almohade reconquest of Spain. With the Arab world goes into regression. It actually goes in like retrograde, backwards. They were more enlightened and open then than they are now. And certainly that's a more fanatical, more like Taliban blowing up and No, women can't learn, shutting down secular knowledge. Anything that's not purely Islamic is, that's more of a trend you see with more fanaticism appearing in Islam. And also when Islam starts to collide with Christianity, they become more reactionary, more fearful of the other. So, but meanwhile, the Jews are largely going to start migrating out of places like Spain because we're expelled in 1492. Many go back to other places in the Middle East, like the Ottoman Turkish Empire. But that's going to be really the growth of the Ashkenazi community, which was quite small, and the few tens of thousands of Jews, primarily in southern France,
Wow.
and in also in Germany on the Rhine in Speyer, Worms, Mainz, and that's a community which, by the way, is suffering terribly under the very deep, dark backwardness of medieval Europe. We had a lot of religious superstition and a lot of very serious, heavy accusations that are leveled against Jews that go back to our original sin of being Christ killer. Jews, unlike in the Islamic world, where Jews were never viewed as being physically threatening, just intellectually deceptive, Jews in Christian Europe are viewed as people who poison wells or in league with the devil, kidnap Christian babies, use their blood to bake matzah. Look, if we could kill God's son, we could do anything. And that explodes into massive open violence after the First Crusade in 1095, with the destruction of many of the Jewish communities of Germany and the Rhine. But at the same time as the media, that's a very dark period of time. Europe is starting to slowly emerge out of its backwardness, whereas the Islamic world is going back into it more and going to the Renaissance, and Jews and Jewish communities start to expand, and Jews start to migrate into the greener pastures of Europe, especially towards the east. So now you have that process of switching over from 90% speaking Arabic, living in Islamic countries. And to the you fast forward to by the time you get to the 18th, 19th centuries, it's 90% Ashkenazi living in Christian countries, speaking Yiddish becomes the language. So it's a very, it's an amazing transference, amazing, amazing change in how the Jewish world switched so totally. And then the Sephardic world, this world of the Middle Eastern communities, that becomes the outlier communities. It's no longer the center of secular academic study in the Jewish world, nor certainly not in the Torah world. Almost all the Rishonim, those great rabbis who exist until the expulsion from Spain, almost all of them are Sephardic rabbis. They're Middle Eastern. After that, almost all the Acharonim, and everyone who comes later, with a few exceptions, almost all the great rabbinic leadership has been coming out of Europe.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So that in itself creates a culture shift in terms of practice, in terms of thought, in terms of influence, because if the great leaders and teachers at one point are coming from the Islamic world as Jews, suddenly the thought leaders are coming culturally from the Christian world as Jews. So I'm sure that that also shows a shift in practice, a shift in colloquial ideas, a shift in, how do we blend into this civilization and safely live our lives while at the same time remaining true to our Jewish practice in some way. So that's really fascinating. So is it like that basically coming up to just before the Shoah? What does that look like in the Ashkenazi world? And then where do we go from there?
Right, so the Ashkenazi world really explodes with the 16th century, with the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth being created and openly inviting Jews in, because even if they didn't like us, they always needed us. Which reminds me of the episode of All in the Family, Archie Bunker. He didn't like Jews, but he had a Jewish doctor, a Jewish lawyer, and a Jewish accountant. That's like the history of Europe and everywhere. We always came in very handy, being literate and well-connected and spread around the world. So Jews are invited into these places, and we do very, very well. And because we do well, we prosper, relatively speaking. We multiply demographically to a huge number, like 1,500, maybe 50,000 Jews living in Eastern Europe. What is Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine? You're going to have, by the time you get to 1700, maybe that's 500,000 Jews. By the time you get to the late 19th century, before you have mass exodus of Jews, 5.5 million Jews living in what now the Tsarist Russian Empire. Just like in Spain, where it's the Golden Age, and then the Almohades come in, and the Christian reconquest and the expulsion, the changing external circumstances are going to put us in a much greater state of anxiety, fear, physical threat, and ultimately immigration from those places. The situation in Europe never stays static. We're going to have in the 16th century, there's the Khmelnytsky massacres. Ukrainians rise up in revolt, led by a Cossack leader, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, and the major target, because Jews were used, the arrenda system, where Jews are basically subcontracting out from the Polish-Lithuanian landlords to run their estates, were the guys who are running everything. So the most of the violence is leveled at Jews coming from a place that is deeply superstitious, very Christian, and often deeply anti-Semitic, going back to, you know, the earliest anti-Semitic tropes against the Jewish people.
So that means not only are we in the diaspora, but we can't even settle in the diaspora. We're constantly having to run. We're constantly either being kicked out or having to find safe haven, you know, consistently resettling on a regular basis. You know, I guess is that where this idea of, say, the wandering Jew comes from, like that we can't put our feet down. If you can imagine a family that can't find a home, they're just constantly homeless, constantly moving around, constantly living in a state of unsafety and non-stability. So right. That's really sounds like what the Jewish community was like, you know, through those, how many years are we looking at?
We're talking about you can go through half a millennia of that in Eastern Europe for sure. Yeah, and the wandering, you know, on a level of Jewish worldview, hashkafa is clearly because we're never allowed to permanently stay anywhere. And one of the great, interesting supernatural trends of Jewish history is the more comfortable we've gotten any place, the bigger the explosion of anti-Semitism, which is counterintuitive, but it's precisely the point that if we stay there too long, get too comfortable, we disappear. And Jews in Eastern Europe are always, I think, a lot more not at ease, you know, than Jews living in places like Spain in maybe the 9th century. It's always a certain level of, you know, like, you're aware that you're living as a stranger in a strange land, but people, Jews are very comfortable there. They're much more comfortable than a place like Eastern Europe. But the collective psyche of that Jewish community is very different, I think, than like Jews of Spain, because it was never as stable, never as good, never a golden age. And by the time Europe becomes enlightened, Jews don't have really the ability. We never managed to materialize to people who could remain Torah observant and enlightened like the Jews of Spain did. That's what that was the attempt by people like Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer to create what's called modern orthodoxy, to try and engage. But by that point, the Jewish world just seems to be too traumatized and too disconnected from the larger culture.
For nuance, right?
Yes,
like new when you to have nuance and balance, you have to be in a healthy place. Otherwise, you're in black and white. Like you're either the extreme this way or the extreme that way. You're completely in or you're completely out. And it's very hard to have a balanced approach when you're running and in survival mode.
Exactly, which is why you see in the Ashkenazi world something you don't see. You know, you have forced conversions in Spain, which wasn't done out of choice, but Jews converted, not because they wanted to be Christians, but they're going to lose everything. The Ashkenazi world, the only people you get really engaging with the outside secular world once Europe gets to the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the opportunities are incredible, are Jews who are leaving their Judaism behind.
Completely.
You know, all the rest of
you're
the Jewish
out
world.
Or you're totally in.
Right. The rest of the Jewish world is becoming a Torah-only world. With a few attempts to try and synthesize the two, which really don't take off. That's what modern orthodoxy comes from much later in history and not really anywhere near successfully. So you never have in the Ashkenazi world, what you have in the Sephardi world is never duplicated in the Ashkenazi world. A world where people are tremendously accomplished as rabbis and scholars, and a world where they're at the same time tremendously engaged in the larger culture. You know, these rabbis used to have these poetry rap session things going on there in Spain. It was like, that was like the rap music then was these, you know, that
so
was
cool.
They were like really artsy and cool, like bohemian rabbi, scholar, scientist, poet things. Poetry was considered a really amazing way to display your intellect and you know, freestyle poetry session kind of thing. So you don't have that ever. And it has to also go, as you're talking about trauma, you're mentioning before, the Ashkenazi world has been traumatized for far longer than the Sephardic world and gone through much more severe trauma. So by the time you get to Jews living in Eastern Europe before the mass emigration of Tsarist Russian persecution, and even which comes another half a century later with the Holocaust and the destruction of that entire community, you are dealing with a community that is in and along, Ellie, with the physical threats that are coming from the outside.
Yeah.
Khmelnytsky massacre, Tsarist Russian persecution, pogroms, Holocaust, Russian Revolution. Wow. You also have something you also didn't have at any period of time, except maybe the time of the Maccabees, with Jews trying to Hellenize, become Greek. You have massive movements of Jews being attacked from without spiritually by being attracted to either completely alien ideas, like political ideologies, like communism and Bundists and socialists and that kind of stuff, and Jews being pulled by other movements of Judaism. Reform movement in Europe, conservatives uniquely American, secular Zionist movement, which is stealing, so to speak, I'm saying them like quotation marks, Jews away from Judaism. So now think about how that Ashkenazi community is feeling. We're getting it from both ends. It's like being in a room with a guy punching you and throwing cold water on you and then flashing lights in your face, keeping you awake and tormenting you by with a light in your face, yelling questions at you. So it's like psychological trauma, physical trauma, which really builds in that Jewish world. I always say on an epigenetic level, even.
Yeah.
It's been very proven that Holocaust survivors' children have epigenetic damage.
Yeah.
But I think, honestly, it's one of these great PhD theses that someone who's a Jewish historian who also has a degree in psychology should write a thesis on the epigenetic trauma, which we pay a huge price for because it caused that world to become very inwardly focused, extremely reactionary.
Right.
And also, by the way, has taken a lot of the creativity and the joy out of Judaism. I mean, Hasidut was an attempt to really reestablish some of that in a very difficult situation economically and politically of Jews in Eastern Europe. Mm. Let's give you a little bit of something, even if you can't learn, you know, in yeshiva, at least try and connect somehow spiritually and get some joy out of Judaism.
Right.
Otherwise, end up like Tevye the milkman and Filler on the Roof. You know, God, you chose us. Couldn't you choose someone else? Which is the worst possible way to look at Judaism. I'm not saying Orthodox Jews look at it that way. They're very, very proud of who they are as Jews, but it's a lot of reactionary trauma that's so deeply ingrained in the collective Jewish psyche that is spilled into the Orthodox Jewish world of today, regardless of whether it's, and even if it's not living in Eastern Europe anymore, because that world's gone.
Right.
It's transferred itself to Europe and America.
Yeah. And it also sounds, if we think about it, we often associate the epigenetic, like intergenerational trauma to the Holocaust. But I suspect the epigenetics were already there going all the way back to the destruction of the temple. So we're actually dealing with major trauma, and then all of the being kicked out of there and kicked out of here and accused of this and accused of that. So it was already so much built in that in many ways we were, we think of the Shoah as the most major trauma, but, you know, I hasten to say this, but it was one of so many.
Exactly.
And really just, kind of the kicker on so many levels. So, okay. So I feel like, based on what we've said, we've come up to just before, what did the Jewish world look like right before the Shoah? And as we said, now we can kind of see the Shoah even in context to all of the trauma that has already happened and what Jewish practice looks like and why at this point. So I think what we'll do is we're going to break this into two parts. And next week we'll come back and begin from the community of Jews right before the Holocaust. What did that world look like? What did practice look like? How did we observe Judaism? And then, the Holocaust itself, and then where we went from there. How did we rebuild the world? And what did that inevitably make our Judaism look like now? How does that sound, Ken? Can we divide it up?
That sounds fantastic, because really that period of time, it corresponds to, the destruction of the largest Jewish community in the world, the rise of America as the new, golden Medina, wherever, not just on a physical and material level, but on a Torah level, but also the creation of a Jewish state. And now what's interesting, Ellie, we we stirred up the pot, and now we're pouring it all back into a different pot, which is back into Israel. And I think when we understand that journey, especially the last 100 years,
and
less, then a lot of what's going on in the Jewish world today, whether it's in the diaspora and in America, and especially what's going on in Israel, it makes a lot more sense to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's definitely the way to go.
I start to see that now when we really look at the 30,000 foot view of how much the Jewish people have been through, we can start to see why they make some choices that they make that seem so odd for people who want to be in their land together under one God. But we don't seem to manage that so well, but it's starting to become apparent some of the reasons why. So amazing. Okay. So we'll come back next week. We'll begin, we'll begin in the middle and then we'll get to where we are now. Hopefully. Ken, thank you so much. This is just fascinating. Amazing. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.